you know, we try to figure out how can we set this up to, of course, we have to get paid back as a lender, but how do we make it term? So we have terms of 15 years on our notes. So it's not like they got to pay back. It's 5 years or anything. You know, anywhere from, we do have a 10-year option, again, trying to show them how, hey, if this is affordable, this could be a lot cheaper for you down the road, but we do have 15-year options as well. It's really up to them and where they're at financially that makes sense for the best for them.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll. Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. I'm your host, Tate Duryea. I'm here with my wonderful co-host, Ryan Gibson. What's going on, man? Good to see you again.
Reporting for duty. Excited to be on another podcast. And this time, we're going to be talking about lending, aviation lending for those that are looking to get their pilot's licenses or licensures, whatever you say. They're going to get loans that pay for their flight training. And what's cool is if you're like, oh, I'm not getting a loan for my pilot training, or I'm not looking into that either. We're not just talking about getting loans. We're talking about the mechanics of how you can invest in companies that provide these loans too. So we're going to get into that later in the show. So how about that? That's pretty cool.
Yeah, we had a really, really fun conversation. Anthony Garacci is the co-founder and CEO of Stratus. They provide flight school loans. And I don't know about you, but I've mentored dozens of friends, colleagues, friend of friends through the process of how do I make a career in aviation over the last decade. And one of the big issues is financing, right? How do you get a $100,000, $125,000 loan to get through the process? And, you know, you can go through the institutions, Fannie Mae, Ameriprise, or whatever. There's some big institutional lenders, but what they're doing is creating a private lending basket and doing private flight school loans.
Yeah, really cool, interesting guy. He's a pilot himself and got inspired when, you know, he heard people stalling out in training because they didn't have funding. So he's like, I need to make a solution for that. And, you know, this show, we're all about building your passive income and investing in alternatives. So we kind of wrap up in the end with that. And we even talk about the future of aviation and sort of the pilotless cockpit that everybody's talking about, or flight deck, and our thoughts on that. So with that, let's get into the show.
Anthony, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you on here, Anthony, because in the world of flying, we never really know how to get financial assistance or loans for aviation. And I remember when I was going through, I think I was my multi-engine add-on, my father and I looked at getting a loan that was like 10% back in the days when it wasn't like 10% loans. It seemed like a deal with the devil. And I just, you know, it was really discouraging. And I think we figured out how to pay for it another way. But, you know, for those aspiring aviators out there that are looking to roadmap their financial future and how to pay for their flying, in other words, you know, that's why we brought you onto the show. And but before we get into that, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into the flying world. And I see your shirt, the okayest pilot out there.
Yep. Not too great, not too bad, just right in the middle.
Love it.
Yeah, so it's funny. So by trade, I'm an attorney, and I grew up in the private lending space or hard money lending space, depending on what you like to call it anymore. And I've been doing that for about 17 years. But during COVID, these stories are always, I think, random, but during COVID, I learned how to fly, and I'll tell you exactly how it all happened. A buddy of mine owned a flight school in Riverside. He has since sold it. He's actually my partner in Stratus now. But I told him, hey, my ex has my kids. My girlfriend's out of town. I want to do something this weekend. I heard about this thing called the Catalina Wine Mixer, which, if you guys ever watched Step Brothers, it's crazy that they actually created this after Step Brothers bring tourism to Catalina Island. It's just random. And he said, look, you take care of the hotel, I'll take care of the flight. And I think literally nothing about this. But then, you know, I arrive at John Wayne Airport at ACI Jet. And I think I'm, you know, chugging down a water and a Red Bull at this point, just sitting there. And he flies in, pays, you know, for gas and landing fees. I know this after the fact, not during the time. And then we get in the plane. And it's a 15-minute flight to Catalina. And I ask what I think are all the stupid questions that a non-pilot can ask, which is, don't you have to file a flight plan? You know, and all those random things that we could laugh about now is like, and just get in the world of it. And it really just opened my eyes to freedom. So I was like, God, I got to learn how to do this just to take myself and my family places. And so I started training the next month. October of 2019 was when I started, but I got my license May 8th of 2020, you know, hard, deep in the COVID time. But you know, as a result of learning it, just got into the flight school regime, if you will. I don't know if you guys hung around flight schools back in the day when you were getting your licenses. That seemed to be the thing. Tons. And just soaking up knowledge while I'm there. And I still remember asking the dispatcher, you know, so I got my private. I was working on my instrument rating. So I know 7 months I got my private and then working on the instrument rating from there. And he's working on his instrument rating, but he'd been a private pilot for 4 years. And, you know, I'm nosy sometimes and I like to ask stupid questions as we talked about. I was like, Michael, I just got to ask you a question, man. You're doing this for a career. I'm doing this for fun, you know? And he's like, well, yeah, but there's no funding as a result of this. I was like, I don't understand. And that's how, you know, digging into that, that's how Stratus was born.
Well, you know, the four forces of flight, right? Money,
money,
money, money, and money.
Yep.
That's right.
Well, you know how to make a million, become a millionaire in aviation, right?
Yes.
You start with a billion.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. And we all know how, right. You know, there's a pilot on the show, he'll tell you. Well, yep. Cool. So I guess, like, you know, you're going to get into this and I'm excited about hearing everything you're going to talk about, you know, for financing. I want you to kind of hit it from two different ways, if you don't mind. One from the like college kid or, you know, young aspiring aviators position, but also I want to touch on the late in life people that want to, you know, maybe just go get their private or something. I know I have a friend, an avid listener of the show, actually, I'll give him a little shout out, who, you know, is thinking about getting his pilot's license next summer and is a, you know, established in his medical career and wants to be a pilot, right? And so is this a lucrative thing for them too? Or is it just for somebody on a career track that wants to get financing for aviation? So
yeah, for us, I mean, we'll finance both. For me, though, as funny as this will sound, I think it makes more sense for the aspiring aviator than maybe the later in life person. And I'll dig into that a little bit. Because at the end of this, you know, I fast forward to the end and we'll talk about interest rates and all that stuff. But at the end is a career. And I'm assuming they want this as a career. Now, if the three of us were talking even 5 years ago, we could even question their sanity about a career, you know, as first officers getting paid 50 grand if they're lucky. But, you know, I don't know how, you know, if you guys seen the payment hikes and all that stuff. So your regional first officer is now making 120 grand at even Piedmont, you know, just a no-name carrier right now. And we're not even talking about the Part 135 jobs or anything out there. So, I think a loan would make a lot of sense for those people who, okay, I'm going to get a loan. I'm going to sacrifice, you know, 2 years of my time, of course, going through it. I'm going to be paying $800 a month or whatever the loan looks like for them. And it's a student loan like the rest of us faced, I think, even for me in law school. You know, I came out with $1,000 a month payment, but I'm thankful because I came out with a $135,000 job too. So, you know, it's like that trade-off right there versus like the later in life, if they're looking to get their private, there's no income at the end of the day unless there's some career they want to do, maybe medevac or something like that, that, you know, maybe they're not thinking. In which case, I would highly recommend don't get a loan. That's one that makes sense. Go get cash. In fact, you know, for their medical career, if you have a little bit of cash, you may even want to consider buying like a Cessna, even 152 or something. You can pick those up for 30 or 40 grand. And then you hire the CFI for $50 an hour. Just thought processes on how to make it cheaper.
Makes sense.
Well, what are your thoughts on buying an airplane, you know, as someone who's making a career change, who has access to, say, financing and doing that instead of going to, say, a structured school where you're renting the airplane all the way through? This is a total left field question. Lou, we can get back on track, but that's just something that bubbled up right there.
Honestly, I don't think there's a better time to do it than now. You know, and again, I'd love your experiences because you guys, of course, flew professionally. And so I'm recently to the space, like 5 years or so. And I saw this changes that Delta made. You know, Delta required a 4-year degree up until 3 years ago as the pilot shortage happened. And so maybe there would be saying something, no, you need to go to part 141 at least rather than part 61 training. But nowadays, all these airlines are like, we need pilots. If you got an ATP and your check ride history is fairly clean, we'll take you. And so there's to me, there could be some differences as far as check ride prep and stuff like that. But otherwise, you know, all things being equal, I would probably go buy a plane. And I did, by the way. I bought my plane to train in, and my training was probably a tenth of the cost, especially factor in, get an older plane, right? Most of the depreciation is out of it. And you could sell most planes for at least the same amount as you bought it. You know, of course, we've been able to appreciation market lately, but even today, you probably get that out of it, what you put into it, and you can hire a CFI to train in.
All right. So I saw something on Instagram last night. I was off social media for a while, and then I went back. It was a reel. This guy came on and he was like, you can buy an airplane for $1 million, let's just say, for easy math. And you put down, I don't know, $200,000 or $300,000. And you get the depreciation from the airplane. You can 100% depreciate the airplane. Am I right? Am I still on solid ground here?
It's going to be 80% depreciation.
Is that what it is? 80%?
Are we talking bonus depreciation? Or are we talking straight line?
I don't know. That's what I'm trying to get to. But you can, so you get the 80%. Let's just say it's 100% depreciated, right? We could back off the 20% or what here in a second. Mm-hmm. Let's just say it's 100%. So you get the whole thing written off, and then you get this massive tax break, and then you entered into service into a flight school, you lease it back, and now you're like basically no money out of pocket with your tax savings, and you've got a plane at the flight school that you basically can fly on the cheap, and it's in a professionally run organization. And I was kind of thinking, man, maybe aircraft ownership doesn't sound so bad. I just hadn't heard that strategy. And I know we're talking about paying for flight school here, but you know, for maybe there's a parent out there who's like doing real estate deals and they want to get their son or daughter or whoever into flying. I mean, that could be a strategy. Like you buy a plane, you depreciate it, you get it entered into a flight school, and that's a way to hack your way into, you know, building hours and flying.
100%. Yeah. And I can tell you the smaller flight schools would be more than open and receptive to that kind of arrangement. A lot of the smaller ones lease planes anyway from people and you know, from individuals to add to their flight school, you know, program, if you will. So I think there's a heck of a strategy.
Now,
and
are you providing those loans?
Yeah. No, but we have partners that if they want an airplane loan, like, and we make nothing from it. Just, you know, as you get part of the industry, happy to make referrals to anybody we know. And I've got a gentleman who, as long as the plane is under $500,000, he'll make a loan. You know, it's higher now, but about 6 or 7% interest on a plane.
Wow, nice.
That's incredible. Yep. Interesting strategy.
Yeah.
Okay, didn't mean to completely derail there. let's talk about Stratus.
It's all aviation. I love talking about this stuff. We go anywhere
this
you guys
is great.
Want.
This is great.
That's right. And by the way, Anthony and I met in a WhatsApp chat forum, didn't we? Is that where we were at? Yeah, WhatsApp's taken
over. Yeah, YPO Pilots, I think.
YPO Pilots. So I'm part of the YPO chapter in Seattle, which is really cool. And you're part of the Pacific West regional chapter. So pretty cool. But anyway, yeah, let's jump into it. Let's talk about, you know, if I'm a student pilot, maybe put me back into where I was. You know, I was in college. I didn't go to an aviation school. I was driving an hour to a flight school in between classes to learn how to fly. How would I use Stratus to finance my multi-engine rating? I needed to get, like, I think, you know, however many hours it was, maybe 25, 30 hours. How would that work?
Yeah, there's two ways. If you came to us directly, you could apply with us directly. And even if we don't have a relationship with a school, we'll usually find a way to work with them. But we have currently 160 schools we partner with. So likely we're working with them. And if we're not, then we're more than willing to work with them. Either way, so let's just say I'll take the first scenario. So they apply directly to us. And then you know, they're identifying the flight school they want to go to. As we all know, you know, almost every airport has a flight school, even the municipal ones. Not usually have two or three. So it's really up to the student. They got a flight school. Hey, I want this multi-engine add-on from XYZ flight school. Great. You know, you go through our normal approval process, and I'm going to assume you're approved. Great. Then no problem. We'll fund the entire amount, 25, 30 hours, and call it $200 an hour, $300 an hour, to $10,000. We'll fund the entire $10,000. Connect us with the school. We'll work with their finance department, or, you know, if they're small enough owner, whoever the decision maker is there, and we'll finance them in any way that they would like. You know, part of our things, we want to make sure the student gets the training they want. So we work with the schools to, hey, make sure that we get logbooks and everything, make sure they're getting the training they deserve, and sift for the check ride to get the multi-engine out of.
That's great.
For an aspiring pilot who is young and this is what they want to do for a career, or someone who's pursuing a career change and they're going from zero to hero, you know, I've recommended ATP. We're going to talk about the elephant in the room here to a number of people because that's my alma mater as of 18 years ago. Pretty crazy. But I'm kind of working with some old data now that I'm seeing. And I have a good friend who went to the Zero to Hero course, signed up with their institutional lending partner and had a terrible experience. So I know that lending can be very difficult if you wanted to go to a local flight school, use local CFIs who might have a lot more experience. And that's sort of what I'm pushing him towards now. Now that he's out of ATP, he scrapped that plan. And I'm like, hey, let's get you over to a local flight school who has better instructors, better experience in a better location, that isn't necessarily this. You know, ATP is a Part 61 school, but it's very institutionalized and canned, and it's got a course. That seems to be easier to lend on for most lenders than, say, just a local flight school. So can you talk about the difference between Stratus and, you know, Fannie Mae?
Absolutely. Yeah, happy to do so. So I think the founding point is we are pilots who are student lenders versus student lenders who fund pilots. So we have a very deep understanding of the at least flight school market. You know, again, my partner is named Brandon Martini, and he's our COO. He sold his flight schools. So we have just a deep understanding of how they're run, what they look for, as well as how to work with them best. And so when we start funding programs, if you will, for these flight schools and everything, we absolutely make sure they have a syllabus as well. So, you know, if you don't have a syllabus, we're not going to fund you. If this is just a hobby school of yours and maybe you take on a couple of students, great, that whatever makes sense for them. You know, but we won't fund them unless it's more, if you will, professionalized. So they have to teach from syllabus, even if it's a professional one, like GLIME is out there and a few others. Use a professional syllabus. At least you know you're doing something to train towards the what is now the ACS, if you guys are familiar, the Airmen Certification Standards, and doing something to get these people ready for training versus just seems like a great idea to fly out there. So that's one aspect. The other one is, again, we work with both the students and the flight schools. Part of our agreements are, hey, if there's any disagreements or if there's something, we really encourage both the flight school and the students to work it out. And if we need to help moderate or mediate, happy to make it happen. But at the end of the day, we want to make sure both sides are satisfied, the flight schools as well as the students. And I got to say, almost all of our flight schools, they care about their students as well. I can tell you many times is they make sure that their accounts are correct. And then if even the student has any issues with us, they'll work with us. But it's a good partnership, you know, what they call that tripartite relationship between us, the flight school, and the student. Make sure everything's taken care of and everybody is happy with both the training they're getting as well as any issues that do pop up every now and then. But all in all, I could tell you a lot of our partner schools, it's not just ATP, but probably I'd be guessing, I wasn't ready for this type of question, but probably about 15 or 20 of our flight school partners already have agreements with Southwest and some of the other regional airlines that they will get interviews. So, you know, I think this was a selling point at ATP back in the day, but a lot of these flight schools have now had those same relationships that ATP does. So there's a lot of options out there for students, you know, kind of to your point of, you know, ATP is of course the big one out there, but there's several options. And again, every airport has more than one flight school. And of course, ATP is probably there too, as well as other flight student schools that they should just interview and really make sure they want to be where they're at.
Tate, you said your guy at ATP had a bad experience, and I went to ATP too, and I loved it. So I'm in your camp.
I had a blast. Yeah,
yeah, they did.
It's a bummer to hear that the quality is coming down. And from what I hear,
was it the loan that was bad, or the training that was bad, or both, or something else?
The training.
Oh, the training.
Unfortunately, yeah, the training just wasn't great. Got caught up in the sort of the corporate machine and, you know, wasn't getting flown, had poor quality instructors. It's unfortunate to hear. It sounds like, you know, they've grown a lot over the last two decades, and maybe some of the quality has gone down, and it's just sort of a big machine and you're kind of a number, not a name.
That's too bad. Anthony, what's the terms of the loan? I mean, kind of what's the brass tacks of, and I know rates are subject to change and all that. And as a follow on, I want to get into the borrower because, you know, when I think of like myself, you know, when I was applying, if I would have been applying for these loans, I'd been like 19 years old, no credit history, no job, right? Like, I mean, how do you assess that against another guy or gal that doesn't have any credit or job or anything like that too? So
give you guys an idea. Of course, it's a very broad topic, if you will, depending on who qualifies, whether you can get cosigners, all that stuff. But again, I'll answer as directly as I can. Our rates really start around 10% and go up from there, depending on creditworthiness, cosigners, all that fun stuff. So it just depends on who they are as a person. But we don't focus just on FICO. We want to look at the whole person, if you will. So we look at income. You know, are you going to work during flight school? Some allow them to work during flight school. Some do not. I mean, I work full time myself and then was able to get through it. But of course, I was not on the professional track. And then we look at, you know, who's co-signing. You know, do they have traction elsewhere? You know, do they have assets? Have they shown higher education, for instance? Like we try to take a whole complete picture, not just a FICO score, to figure out, is this person, you know, one, does this make sense for them? Because the number one thing I don't want as a lender is to set a borrower up for failure. And I don't want to give you a loan just to say, hey, you're going to default. That really sucks for both. And you know, we have an internal, you know, dialogue of, you know, if we think they're going to fail, we're just not going to give them a loan. I don't care whether they qualify or not. So that's that. So we have a couple different products depending on how they, you know, they want and they choose. We have a deferred product, you know, so we have a deferred product while in school. And then we have payments that start after school while they're hopefully have a CFI or commercial pilot's license, depending on which way they decide they want to go. But we also have full payments from the day one, if that's what they choose. And as you guys can imagine, if you're paying interest on day one, it's going to be much cheaper for you than if you defer it. And so the whole idea with our loan officers, we really try to educate them. It's like, guys, this is a product, this is available. And likely, again, our deferred products is usually what's selected. But it's like, if you have the ability to make payments today, look at how much money you're going to save. So our loan officers will actually walk them through, you know, you're going to save $100,000 over the life of the loan to make that happen.
Yeah. And how much does it cost to go zero to hero with a loan? Let's just say 10%, you know, in this market, you know, I reflect back on how much it cost me and it doesn't even make sense to talk about the number because I'm sure it's like in 2000, you know, it was paying like $45 an hour for a 152 and I think $15 for the instructor. So those days are gone. What does it cost to go zero to hero? Maybe with a loan and then maybe layer on a traditional, you know, 10%, you know, whatever loan.
Yeah, great question. So it varies all across the nation, funny enough. So we of course, do not set the rates, right? We set our loan rates, but we don't set the flight school costs. All flight schools get to decide how much they're going to charge for the programs they choose. On the low end, I've seen schools do it as cheap as $60,000 from zero to hero. And when we talk about hero, we're talking about getting you a CFI or, you know, commercial. You're still flying for about a year before you get up to ATP standards. Versus, you know, some schools are $100,000, just depending on what they do. And then we, of course, charge, you know, for a small origination fee and then interest on top of that for the loan. So, you know, you can be what's called $100,000 to make it use. And then, you know, we try to figure out how can we set this up to, of course, we have to get paid back as a lender, but how do we make it term? So we have terms of 15 years on our notes. So it's not like they got to pay back in 5 years or anything. You know, anywhere from, we do have a 10-year option, again, trying to show them how, hey, if this is affordable, this could be a lot cheaper for you down the road, but we do have 15-year options as well. It's really up to them and where they're at financially that makes sense for the best for them.
So you're making it optional where I could defer my interest payments and basically pay interest on interest for the payment that I don't make to you during the course of the loan, or I could pay interest-only payments through the course of the loan, and that will reduce the interest on interest that I would be charged throughout the life of the loan, essentially. When you say it's a 10-year note or a 15-year note, am I assuming that's because it's amortizing? So it is amortizing. Does it amortize on day one or how does that work? Well, I guess if you're making payments.
Yeah, it really depends on which selection, right? So, and first of all of our notes have no prepay penalty. So if they actually want to set up a point where, hey, I want this deferment, and if they want to elect to make payments, it's all on our portal. They're welcome to make whatever payments they want. And we tell them that during the time. But yeah, and this is a concept that, of course, you imagine the career pilot, 23 years old, trying to teach them to interest on interest. We have not been very successful, although we mentioned it and say, hey, if you can make payments during school, this would be best for you. But from there, yeah, so our deferment product, for instance, is deferred for a year. And then we have interest only for the next year. You know, so during that first 2 years, as you guys know, that's your training period and then CFI period. We try to keep payments as low as possible based on where they're at, you know, for their flight school programs. And then it fully amortizes over the next 13 years. So it just depends on what they want to do.
So how does it work? Can you only go to one of your partner schools, or can you sort of bring your own flight school, or how does all that stuff work?
Yeah, great question. When we work with partner schools, we know their programs, and so we know how to fund them best for that. But we work with anybody, as long as they're willing to work with us. So we have what we call non-partner schools, so MPS loans. And so they're just not partners of ours yet. And generally, if we're willing to fund a non-partner school, we'd love to have them as partner school. But if they choose to not want to go through our process or anything, we're more than happy to work an arrangement where, hey, we will deposit money on behalf of the student and continue to deposit money as he or she runs out. And, you know, we'll get to the full funding. You know, the difference is we have no idea at the end of the day, is that amount going to be good enough for the graduating? No clue with a non-partner school. With partner schools, we can, you know, get some agreements with the partner school saying, hey, we're expecting them to graduate with this license for this amount of money. And you should be able to make that work. With a non-partner school, we don't have that kind of control.
What does that actually look like in terms of going to your website, seeing your partner school, seeing if you have a partner school in the area that someone wants to go, or do they need to pick up the phone and connect with you?
Yeah, good question. Actually, it's usually the reverse. The partner schools actually advertise us on their websites. So when they look at these partner schools, they usually say, hey, finance through Stratus or anything like that. They're welcome to call us. We're happy to select a partner school in their area where they tell us, and we're happy to give them a list of partner schools. But again, I want to be clear. It's like, we'll finance anyone. If they have a school, I really want to go to the school. No problem. We can figure out an agreement with that school to finance them and make sure that they get the training they need to move forward. It's just, yeah, we with the partner schools, we know, hey, this amount of money will get you this license type of thing. So that's what we do prefer. But it's really, again, the student is in control, not us.
All right. So this is an investing show podcast, and we teach people how to invest in opportunities, syndicate. Now, it's also a flying podcast where we kind of bring in folks like yourself, Anthony, who fly. And maybe there's a lot of airline pilots here that are listening that are thinking, oh, my kid wants to get into flying. And, you know, what's the market like? And but we got to shift gears a little bit because it is an investing podcast. Can I invest in your loans that you give to students on the backside? How does your business work?
Yeah, great question. So we do have a fund that people can invest in, and you know, we've been returning, knock on wood, 13% annually for the last 2.5 years. Insert the disclaimer that future performance, who knows what past performance has done, all that fun stuff. But that's what we've been returning, and it's been pretty good from there. And so yeah, we have a fund that people invest in. From there, at least, you know, is we do one thing. We make loans to students and student pilots only. So that's the ecosystem we live in. But yeah, we have the abilities to invest. We have, you know, what they call it, a Regulation D, a private placement memorandum, all the fun legalities and all the stuff that, you know, you've probably seen as an investors out there. It's what is, I guess, akin to like a fixed income product, you know, is the best analogy to what we do.
Thank you. Yeah, that's awesome. Take it. Go ahead.
Yeah, walk us through the mechanics of the fund and what it looks like on the back end. Is it a variable interest rate that investors can expect that sort of floats up and down with the loan products that you're offering? Is it a basket? Are you diversified across all the loans, or are they in tranches? Give us the background.
Great question. So what we do around that is we have what they call a blind pool concept. So all of our student loans are in one fund. So that's a benefit in the sense of there's diversification. So if one loan doesn't pay, and full disclosure, we've got 6 loans that aren't paying right now. So we have a 3% default rate. Those 6 loans aren't paying. Well, the other 200 are, you know, or in a state of deferment or anything like that, but they're still paying. And as a result, we're able to return a fairly predictable yield. So around 12 or 13%, annually. And so, you know, the default ones will work out. We'll figure out ways to get them either reperforming or you know, unfortunately, it could be a write off at the end of the day. That's part of the investment. But we've never seen anything. You know, we don't anticipate a default rate that's going to, hey, not only just not return, but pierce capital. So it'd be a pretty high double digit default rate for us to not return anything to investors. But yeah, so it's a blind pool. We keep on, you know, it's an evergreen fund as well. So we keep on depositing more loans in there as investors come in. You know, we have credit lines as well with the fund. So it gives us a steady ability to originate and buy loans from our originator, which is, of course, Stratus. So yeah, we don't have any, so it's not like a closed pool. So it's not like we're going to close these off in the next 5 years. For our design, at least, an evergreen fund, you can come in. Let's just say, you know what, you're done investing in Stratus. So SEC requires us to lock it in for a year. That's with most private placements. So we have to lock it in for a year. After that, you're like, hey, Stratus, we want out. Great. We return funds, you know, and go from there and keep on raising capital.
Yeah, it kind of answered my question, which was your redemption period when you mentioned it being evergreen. So for those listeners, we can cover that real quick. Evergreen just means that the fund is never closed. So some of the syndications that me and Tate put on are usually closed-ended, meaning that you have a very specific property that you're buying. It's got a very closed-ended or five-year, maybe four-year, maybe seven-year target hold period. We can only raise money for a certain period of time. That's usually 6 months to 18 months at the maximum. And then it's closed. You have to have a termination date. And so for those investors, as an example, who invested in our income fund at Spartan, or our growth fund, or even Spartan Storage Fund 1, we could only raise money legally for a certain period of time. And then once that capital is deployed into the ecosystem, we can only buy properties for 3 years because there has to be a sunset date. What Anthony is doing, he's running what's called an open-ended fund or an evergreen fund. And so what that means is he has to go, the fund is going to last forever, right? Or it goes on and on and on and on and on. And usually funds like that come with a stepping off point where you can do a redemption. So you can say, hey, just like Anthony suggests, I want my money back, and you can get sort of a cash out. Redemptions, though, I will disclaimer, and I don't know Anthony's, but there's usually stipulations to them. It doesn't mean that you can just snap your fingers and show up to a branch and withdraw the money. There's usually periods in the year that he'll have. And you know, again, I'm not speaking to Anthony's, I'm speaking generically. But those periods could be only open during certain times of the year, like open enrollment periods. They could be restricted to first come, first serve. It could be restricted to funds that are available. So don't think when you get into a redemption period that it's automatic. But as a part of an evergreen fund too, Anthony has to undergo what's called audited financials. So he has to do a mark to market, and he has to do a lot of extra reporting doing an open-ended fund. It doesn't make it any better or any worse. It's just something that he has to do. So very, very interesting that you do that. You know, kind of how long is the funds, when did the funds start, and kind of how long is it? Is it the 5 years right from the beginning? Yeah.
Yeah, great question. So we started February of 2022 in the fund. So we've got financials tracked because, as every great business, I put my money where my mouth is, and I started the first year of the fund just with my own money. So, and, you know, wanted to build a track record and really show people, hey, this is viable as an investment option as well. And also, no one's going to believe you otherwise if you don't put money in there, I think anyway. But yeah, so put it there. So I think we're on 20, don't quote me on it, 26 months, over 2 years, just under three, somewhere in there of returns on that market. Yeah.
What's holding your business up the most? Getting the capital placed or bringing in the capital to place into student loans?
Yeah, right now it's really just getting capital in the door. Gotcha. You know, and we're doing okay capital raise. Don't get me wrong. Is this always need for more capital? You know, the flight school lending space is amazing. I think it was $3.7 billion in 2020, and I've not gotten an updated report, so I can only imagine how big the space is now. Probably at least $5 or $6 billion. Guess, of course, no data on it. As more and more flight schools come in, the demand for pilots. You know, not to take it back to pilots, but you know, you guys probably saw the report by Boeing. You know, we need 30,000 pilots a year for the next 20 years.
Crazy.
You know, all flight schools right now, I think they're producing, there's an article that came out, FAA said they licensed 8,000 ATP pilots so far year to date. I'm like, okay, so we're still 22,000 short.
No, that's incredible. And I think it speaks volume to our industry. It's like, you know, talk about a great time, right? You've got more demand than you can than supply, and you've got the collateral of the borrower. I mean, you're not putting a lien against anything, I don't think. I mean, other than personal credit. But the collateral is essentially knowing that the person's going to make it to 150K regional job, and then eventually maybe a 300 or 400K major airline job or greater, right? So, you know, it's a good time to be in the space. So excellent job on your timing, sir. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Now, I really believe it's funny how it all worked out. Was just, I wish I could tell you, oh, I predicted this. No, we kind of fell into the timing aspect of things, and just kind of moving forward. And I don't want to call it riding the wave, but it really is, in the sense of, I don't know too many professions that as soon as you jump through what I'll call the licensing hoops or whatever that is, you've got that $125,000 job waiting for you. It's yours to lose right now because of the demand for pilots. And that's, to me, where loans make sense. You know, that's why I started from the very beginning. I think a loan makes sense for a student trying to become that commercial or ATP pilot versus someone who's just want to do it just for fun. And, you know, at the end of the day, they've got this career waiting for them just because the sheer demand for pilots. And until someone invents the transporter, I mean, what are we going to do outside of flying airplanes everywhere?
Not going to happen soon.
Well, I want to touch on that because, you know, this is weighing heavily on the minds of a lot of, you know, especially people in their, you know, early 20s or even, you know, the 18, 19 year old who's considering this as a career. There is a lot of talk lately about single pilot cockpits and the advent of AI and how fast we're moving technologically. And I always make the point that, you know, Boeing is still an Airbus. They're still building two pilot cockpits, right? And those airplanes have at least 20-year lifespans. But, you know, I don't want to just blindly, you know, charge ahead and not give some serious thought to the prospect of, number one, the economy has been going gangbusters. And, you know, we all know that the airline industry is cyclical and, you know, we're experiencing this boom right now. And yes, there is a ton of attrition and we need replacement pilots, but also we have economic tailwinds as well. So, and I know you're not an economist, but maybe you could speak to first sort of a two-part. First, the potential for in the next 5 to 10 years, that $125,000 job not being there at the end. And number two, a little bit longer time horizon of the sort of the single pilot single pilot cockpit concept.
Yeah, no, good questions. And yeah, I'm not an economist, but I mean, for your businesses too, right? This is stuff we have to watch to figure out, hey, how do we project our later finances going? Funny enough, I see a little bit of that intertwined, right? So if we go single cockpit in commercial airlines, for instance, we're going to see a reduction of 50% of pilots, right? You don't need 30,000 now, right? You need 15,000, which maybe we'd get faster than that. But I'm skeptical. So sorry to answer your second question first.
That's
first,
fine,
but yeah. I think they're intertwined, which is, I just can't see the FAA saying, you know what, I think single pilot's the way to go and we'll be great. You've seen some of the crashes even now with, there was that crash 4 years ago, something like that in Germany, where it was a guy who was single pilot at the time and he decided to crash into a mountain for whatever reason, right? And I'm not here to, you know, I don't know what happened there, but I just imagine, I would say that I'd see that in, say, cargo planes before we see that in commuter planes, for sure. You know, the cargo is not as precious as, say, people's lives. And so, if the FAA is going to approve it, and I think they have actually some of the turboprop for FedEx single pilot caravans, I see a huge resistance to approving, you know, a single pilot, say for, you know, a Airbus 380. We may have the technology to do it. I just don't see that just from a lot of different ways actually happening. So I think, you know, to do that, we'll see the demand constant. I would rewind it a little bit to COVID, and we saw pilot demand right before COVID continue to creep up. It was just because of COVID and then the lack of air travel just really crashed it down. And of course, that's why we saw the layoffs and everything happen within the airlines. And of course, when demand came back to pre-COVID travel requirements, we just couldn't keep up. So there is a possibility, especially if there's a recession, you might see, you know, what I'll call the luxury travel going away. But at the same time, there was a chance, I think, during COVID and you know, I don't want to call it post-COVID because we're still doing it, but we'll definitely call it now the endemic rather than the pandemic time, that we weren't going to travel anymore, right? Zoom was going to take over everything. Right. We could do all these meetings via Teams and all the technology out there. But I think we all figured out we still can't replace that face-to-face meeting to getting that instant trust just based on who we are as human beings. So if there's going to be a reduction in travel, I could see that. But I don't see a huge layoff for, if you will, permanent elimination of pilot jobs anytime in the near future. You know, we could speculate. Like, there's some sub discussions we could have, like Wheels Up going bankrupt and everything like that. But I think demand will still be strong in the next few years.
Okay, Ryan, I know you want to ask your next question, but before you do, I want to ask the same question to you. You worked for the FAA. You keep your finger very close to the pulse on the economy with Spartan. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, as a consultant for the FAA, just to clarify, I don't want to misrepresent anything. But right. My thoughts are pretty strong. I like to open this conversation with a joke, which is, if Boeing can't make an intercom that doesn't require a rubber band, I think we've got a minute before we're in a pilotless cockpit or reducing as such. You know, I look at the my philosophy is I love talking about this. So I was in a lot of studies for the FAA over the years, you know, when Colgan crashed, you know, flight 3407 and Clarence, New York, outside of Buffalo. You know, I was involved in a lot of regulatory rulemaking proceedings. And one of the things that came up that stuck with me was, you know, if you look back in the beginning ages of aviation, leading causes of crashes were mechanical failures. You know, everybody knows that. You look at the graph and it's like mechanical failure is way up here, pilot error way down here. And you have these heroic stories of these pilots that did these heroic things to save lives. And then you had some regulations that were written in blood, and that's how we built our federal aviation regulations over the years. People crash and die. We learn from those accidents, and then we get better. The industry is different now. The industry is extremely safe. There hasn't been a major accident really from a U.S.-based carrier in over a decade. And when you look at the amount of data that streams off these airplanes, we're not in the regulations written in blood era anymore. We're in regulations written in data. And so what's happening is we're getting data that comes off the airplanes and we're learning from these anomalous events that happen. And we're then changing policy, changing training strategies to kind of curtail what happens. And one thing that comes up over and over again is this concept of pilot error is, you know, pilot error is way, way, way up there. And so everybody wants to pick at that and say, well, you know, the pilot error is the reason why airplanes crash today. And actually, it's not. Pilot error is, pilots are what prevents a lot of things from happening day to day that we don't hear about because they prevent it. And so when you think about the amount of automation on an aircraft, I mean, Tate, on a typical flight, how many times are you using the automation? You use it on every flight, but then the automation starts doing something weird. And what do?
Yeah.
You're there to take over. Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Start peeling off layers of automation.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think when you think about, you know, reducing the number of pilots or taking the pilot completely out of the aircraft, we are so far away, in my opinion, from that because of all the preventative things that pilots do on a day-to-day basis to fix the automation. I mean, I laugh. I mean, like my Tesla Y has an autopilot on it, right? And that thing is getting worse. I mean, I love using that thing and I think it's getting worse, right? And I have to be right there to kind of grab it, right? When it's going to make a mistake. I know that, you know, not everybody has that or whatever, but like that is a perfect example of you can't have an autopilot without a pilot right there to take over because while automation reduces your workload to free you up for other more critical aspects of the flight, you still need somebody right there to take over. And we're not going to see that in our lifetime, I don't think. Go away. I do think that we're going to see some really interesting things like robots in the co-pilot seat. And we're going to see things like Cirrus, you know, return to airport stuff. But, you know, that's like there for everything else has failed, pull the red handle or push the red button, right? That's not a a thing that we rely on. That is a last resort technology. And I think if you're going to scale that mass use, you're going to have, it's going to take you a really long time to get it right. And you see the auto manufacturers struggling with that right now. So that's my opinion. I mean, of course, you know, technology can accelerate faster than I can think about it. But I think we have a long ways to go is what I'm saying. And then you also have the other part of it too, where passenger comfort of not having anybody up there, right? And I think that's another whole nother thing, ball of wax, that that people aren't considering as well. And then the customer service elements that kind of go with having a pilot and et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of decision making that still, I think, we have a long way to go as the technology develops. Anthony, I wanted to bring us back just a little bit, because I am interested in your fund, and I think that's a really neat concept, you know, capital raising for, you know, and then probably a lot of people don't realize the backside of it. They just think of how do I get a loan to get my flight training, but they don't think like, oh, later on I can invest. Those loans, you said there's 6 loans that are defaulting. Why are they defaulting? Is it because the student didn't get through training? Is it because of financial issue? What's the risk in that fund outside of the economy?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wish I could tell you I had one answer. they all have different answers, funny enough. And so I'll give you an idea. One to me does not make sense, because it should, unless something has really changed. And of course, you know, remember, our data comes from talking with the borrower. So we only get that filter, and I don't know what's going on in their lives otherwise. But so one, he's got a CFI, CFII, in fact, and he's should be training people as we're going. And when we talk about our payments, you know, CFI is not, of course, a high paying job, as we all know here. But even today, you know, there's been trickle down effect to CFIs. You should be making about $40 an hour. So I don't know if he's not working or anything like that, but you know, his payment was $800 a month and he said, I can't afford it. It's like, I don't understand. Can you help us understand? And then just the conversation ended from there. So that one shouldn't default because everything else makes sense as far as went through training, got the training they needed. Currently now, of course, working on time to get their ATP license and move to regionals. But you know, it's kind of what you were talking about before. He's on the interest only part now, which, you know, should be affordable if you're working full-time as CFI to at least pay it comfortably. No, but then I look at my own student loans. Was it comfortable back then? No, but it's, you know, a repayment should happen. Another one was exactly like you said, broke their leg during training and, you know, offered a forbearance and all that stuff and really felt bad. And then, well, I'm not going to train anymore. I was like, I understand. Can we figure out something to work on that with you? And they stopped talking to us. You know, and it's almost like a reminder, hey guys, we're not your flight school. We kind of gave you money for this. I'm really sorry it didn't work out. Neither one of us expected you to break your leg. You know, work with us here. And they, again, stopped talking to us. And I, that's the pattern. If there's one universal thing with all 6 borrowers, they just stopped talking to us. Because yeah. if you continue to talk to us as a servicer or as your lender, we'll figure out some way to work with you. You know, maybe partial payments or something. Let's help me help you. And I can't come to, I can only come to the conclusion you give me, which is nope, not going to pay. Good luck type of thing. Wow. So that's the only universal pattern I have.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing. Sorry. I didn't mean to derail the AI automation discussion, but.
No, I think we hit that and that was a wonderful discussion, but I'm glad to be bringing it full circle. Anthony, did I read correctly that on your website that there's some sort of real estate backing on the fund?
Good question. That was so Stratus was actually set up as one of my companies I was going to do many things with. So I think that's probably a holdover because all we do is just do student loans. Although Ryan did say, and we accurately do, we do look at assets as part of our qualifying. You know, let's just say you don't have income and everything like that, but you have, you know, you've got a great FICO and assets. We're more than happy to make the loan to you because we trust, hey, you've been successful in your life. We will, of course, you know, make a loan and we'll figure it out as we go. So we know some of them have real estate, but, you know, we don't take liens on any of this stuff. But we gotcha. Know they have their kind of sizable portfolio.
Well, Anthony, really appreciate your time. A couple things I want to highlight. One, you have a podcast to learn how about flying. So can we get the name of that podcast so we can put it in the show notes?
Absolutely. So it's called Aviation Mentors, and Brandon Martini, who's our COO, and then Carson Vasquez, who's our software developer manager. They're both pilots, of course. And Brandon was actually the guy who trained me to fly. So he does this Aviation Mentors, talks about everything. We were at Oshkosh, for instance, this year. And so they were documenting how, you know, getting everything to Oshkosh and then having the podcast live there. So really for student pilots all the way up to any pilots whatsoever, you know, who loves to talk about aviation, you know, just the different things you encounter as a pilot, with our focus really on student pilots and helping, you know, train them on what's going on in the aviation community. So it's a lot of fun.
Nice.
That's doing such a great service, because I can't tell you how many people I've mentored over the last decade. Through career changes, friends, kids who are interested in it. So to have that platform available is just incredible. So I'm really glad you brought that up. And I'm glad that you're putting it out there to the world. That's wonderful.
Yeah. And then the second thing I wanted to make sure we highlight is how do we learn about your fund more? If somebody wants to do their DD on your fund, do you have a separate website or is it on your main site?
Yeah, it's on our main site. So it's Stratus, Stratus dot finance, not financial. So FINANCE. And we have three separate things, of course, for students, for flight schools, and then for investors. So we have a chief investment officer. His name is Chris Raglin. So I can connect anybody if they want to reach out to me, have to make an intro, and happy to, you know, see if there's something that makes sense for people on the investment side. That'd be awesome.
That's great. And that's the same site you use for student loans as well, right? If you were to go in. Okay, very good.
Correct. You got it.
Awesome. Well, I wanted to wrap things up. Anthony, be respectful of your time. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your wisdom. This has been a really awesome episode, and I'm excited to stay in touch.
Yeah, same. No, guys, thanks for having me. Excited about your podcast and everything, you know, with pilots and passive income. You know, it's something we don't talk enough about, right? You make this money. Now, how do you make money with it, right? And that get us all out of jobs, right? So I love what you're doing, and I'm excited. So yeah, can't wait to see you soon.
Thanks, Anthony.
Thanks, Anthony. Take care.
Thanks again, guys.